Tonight on Dateline.
My husband's not breathing and he's falling to come out of heaven.
It was horrible. To find someone that you love, not knowing if they're dead or alive.
Late afternoon, high-end Las Vegas, 34 hours before the cops seized that silver out in Pahrump. A woman named Sandy Murphy was on the phone with 911. The man who wasn't breathing, the man who owned that silver in the desert, was the very rich scion of one of the big names in Vegas gambling, Ted Minion. And you might just as well have put up a billboard. Reporters rushed to the house just in time to see Sandy wheeled away on a gurney, overcome with grief. As for Ted, he was still inside and decidedly dead. Reporters had so many questions, the police held an impromptu presser in Ted's front yard.
At about 4:05 this afternoon, we received a 911 call of a male not breathing. The fire department paramedics arrived and discovered Mr. Ted Minion on the floor in one of the rooms.
The news gripped the whole town because Ted Minion wasn't just rich and famous. He was bigger than life, maybe the last vestige of a Las Vegas that doesn't exist anymore. Oh, sure, it's still a gaudy strip of pavement lined with money and wishful thinking and lies. But there was a time, good or bad, when, so they say, the mob ran this town, and casinos were owned by characters, like Minions on Fremont Street, family-owned since the 50s. And Sandy Murphy? She was Ted Minion's live-in girlfriend. People didn't quite know what to make of her, or the story she told.
It was horrible. I don't think that anyone could possibly understand what it's like to come home and to find someone that you love not breathing and not knowing if they're dead or alive.
As you can probably tell, Sandy was incarcerated when I interviewed her 2 decades ago. Life sentence. For reasons. Well, she had her own idea about the reasons.
There was a driving force that ultimately wanted
someone to pay?
Someone to pay the price for Tenny's death.
Who did kill Ted Minion?
Can I answer that, John?
The young woman sitting with me in the jail that long ago day was clearly bright, very charming. She leapt easily from tears to laughter to indignation and back again. She was either candid as she told her story or a very good liar.
When you come home and you find someone that you love dying, you want to do everything you can to help them. I tried to perform CPR. I tried to do everything I could to help him before that ambulance came that day.
Before Sandy Murphy was the girlfriend of a recently deceased casino magnate and a prime suspect, she was, by her own account, a California cliche, a surfer girl.
My dad was a surfer, so when we were kids, he used to take us to watch him surf.
He taught you how?
Nope, he didn't teach me how.
Did it yourself?
Yep.
Her life as carefree as can be. Until, late teens, it became really anything but.
Well, when I was in high school, I fell in love with a significantly older man.
Short story. They moved in together.
We had real life issues. You know, we had a house payment and car payments and, you know, real life.
It was a bad idea from the start. Here she was, barely out of high school, all tied down. She needed a break, she said.
I think it was just a time for me to let loose and to be a kid and to just have fun and anything goes and it'd be okay.
In the winter of 1995, at the age of 23, Sandy scraped together all the cash she could and, with a friend in tow, headed for Las Vegas.
How long did you intend to be in Vegas?
2 weeks.
So what happened when you got here?
We went gambling and lost.
Wait, who's we?
Just a friend of mine, a girlfriend. Oh.
So. One day? You lost all your money?
Yeah, one day.
You might think that would be the time to pack up and slink home. But Sandy and her friend weren't done with Vegas just yet.
So my girlfriend designs clothes and costumes for dancers, exotic dancers, and we ended up at a local nightclub here called Cheetahs.
The Cheetahs Association continues to bother Sandy. She was always known in the press as the stripper girlfriend to Binion, but she maintains she never did that. She and her friend were at Cheetahs, just having fun, she said, selling costumes to the strippers to make money.
So that was a way to get money.
Oh, absolutely.
But you'd only been here a couple of days when this was happening.
Absolutely. But it was still, I mean, we had a great time. It didn't hinder our vacation at all. Actually, I think it enhanced it. It might have been good luck we lost the money.
Because one night, just hanging out at Cheetahs, Sandy met Ted Binion.
The first night that I met him was on a Friday night, and he was sitting with a character by the name of Herbie Blitzstein.
This is him. Fat Herbie Blitzstein, everybody called him. He was, no getting around it, a mobster. Remember that name. It's going to come up later.
We ended up sitting and drinking, and they were a lot of fun, and they had great stories, and we were there to have a good time. And we hit it off, and they invited us to come out the next night.
And the next night, and the next night, and the one after that. And when Sandy's 2 weeks were up, and it was time to return to California, she realized Ted Binion meant more to her than just the chump who picked up the check. True? Huh. Watch carefully.
I fell in love with Teddy. He was great.
Fell in love with him?
Absolutely.
What was Teddy, it about him you loved?
He's very charming in his own way, and he's kind of a tough guy, which there comes a lot of sex appeal with tough guys. I have this terrible ability to always fall in love with, I have the bad boy syndrome. He was fun and exciting and intelligent and kind of rough and tough and, just a real man's man.
What was it about him that made him rough and tough and a bad boy?
You know, he just rode around in a beat-up pickup truck with red interior and, you know, had long hair and Levi's and dirty shirts and he didn't care.
Ted's I'll-do-what-I-want attitude went beyond the truck he drove and the whiskey he drank. Went to the use of drugs. In his case, heroin.
He told me that in the past that he had had a problem with heroin.
But that didn't stop Sandy from moving into Ted's place.
When I met Teddy, you know, you would never dream that he had the money that he did.
Ted's wealth became very real, though, the day he handed Sandy a credit card with her name on it.
And he says, here, this credit card has like a $10,000 a month allowance on it.
Whether Sandy knew it or not, 10 grand was a rounding error. Ted was worth a lot more, like 70 million more. Money that can make life very easy or very, very complicated.
Coming up, one complication, a suspicion that Ted's father had links to the mob.
They got as much attention as Dean and Frank and the others.
And rumors that Benny Binion was a killer.
He didn't shy away from stories about that. Whether they were true or not, I don't know.
When Dateline continues.
Ted Binion was a man of contradictions, a good old boy who liked to hunt, but also collected art, who drank whiskey straight up, but at times smoked heroin, who drove a battered old pickup truck but gave Sandy a shiny new Mercedes, who had tens of millions in the bank, but was widely known to keep piles of cash in his home, not to mention the silver he stashed at the casino, or buried out in the desert like some sort of swashbuckling pirate. And while he was most comfortable in a work shirt and Wranglers, Ted wanted Sandy to dress in a way that men would notice, telling her,
I want you to be able to go buy beautiful clothes, and beautiful clothes are expensive.
I want you to be able to go to dinner when you want so that you have money whenever you want and you don't have to ask me because I don't want my woman to work. He had his role and I had mine. And my role was to be the woman of the house and to take care of him.
And look good.
Not really to look good, but I wanted to be attractive for my man.
A man old enough to be her father, but wealthy enough for her to pretend he wasn't. At least, that's how Ted's sister Becky Bainan viewed it. Pretend.
And I thought maybe she was just going to be a passing fancy. I thought that it would be something that would just be something that would come into his life and go on and then there'd be someone else. But I was wrong.
Sandy said she knew Ted's sister didn't like her, but she didn't care. Given what she said Ted told her about the Binion family.
I don't think anyone in the family really likes anyone, to be honest with you. I mean, Teddy doesn't get along with his sister doesn't get along with him.
And there were certain periods in the Binion family history of which Sandy, at first, was quite ignorant. For instance...
My father was in illegal gambling in Texas.
Yes, the big man, Ted and Becky's dad, Benny Binion.
An article in Texas Monthly magazine back in the 90s was titled, "Forget the Sopranos, Meet the Binions," which kind of tells you something. Benny got a start in the gaming business running underground gambling halls in Dallas during the Depression, a racket he ruthlessly protected.
Benny was convicted of killing one rival, arrested for killing a second, and suspected of killing a third. In the Binion origin story, Dad, I tailed it out of Texas after things got hot with a competing gang in Fort Worth.
January of 1947, just about the time Bugsy Siegel opened the Flamingo, we got in the car and came to Las Vegas.
Benny built from scratch one of Las Vegas's first major league casinos and then put his name up on it in lights. Binion's, known the world over as the Golden Horseshoe, home to the World Series of Poker. Built in a time when the mob was Las Vegas.
Meyer Lansky, Tony Spilotro, Joey Cusimano.
All reputed mafiosos, as well as clients of attorney and former Las Vegas mayor, Oscar Goodman.
What can I tell you? These fellas needed me. I was maybe the only thing or person who kept them from the electric chair or the gas chamber or life sentence.
Goodman said it was a time when members of the mafia were just as famous as any member of the Rat Pack.
They got as much attention as Dean and Frank and the others. And they had the same kind of adulation from the average member of the public. They say, there's little this, there's Wingy that, there's Hoppy this, with all their nicknames.
Benny Binion, a friend of Goodman's, was known as the Cowboy.
I had the privilege of eating lunch with him just about every day with some other fellas over at the Horseshoe. And he was a great storyteller.
And according to Goodman, Benny would always order the same country lunch.
Squirrel stew. And the, well, no.
There's no such thing as squirrel stew. Come on.
I'll tell you, when you saw that little head poke itself its way out of the bowl, I'm dead serious, with the little glassy eyes and the teeth just smiling at you, it was squirrel stew. And he had it every single day.
A tall tale? Maybe. Maybe not. Like many stories told about Benny, some about killing people, some Benny even told himself.
He didn't shy away from stories about that. Whether they were true or not, I don't know.
One story is it was very much true. The time Ted Binion, who was 25 at the time, was the target of a kidnapping plot. This was back in the 60s when gangsters did things like that. And then one of the kidnappers got cold feet, ratted out his pals to Benny. And days later, the ringleader of the scheme was executed, gangland style. So rumors swept Las Vegas that Benny Binion ordered that hit. But there was never any proof.
Anyway, no daddy issues for young Teddy. He wanted to be just like his old man.
Yeah, I'd love you.
In a video tribute made one year for Benny's birthday, he said,
"But the truth of the matter is he don't worry about anything of win or lose. If he's broke, he goes to sleep just the same as if he's rich."
And maybe Teddy was describing himself, too.
Teddy was unique. Teddy was as smart a fella as I'd ever met. He was street smart. I think they would call it grift smart.
You like Teddy, huh?
Oh, I like Teddy very much. I liked all the Binions.
According to his sister, Becky, Ted worked hard, helped manage the family casino.
Ted was excellent on the casino floor. He was just a natural when it came to dealing with customers and handling numbers and handling the games. He was just a natural.
Ted was almost a mini Benny, even in his friendships with underworld types. In Ted's case, it was Fat Herbie Blitzstein.
They called him Fat Herbie, but he wasn't fat. He was all muscle. He was a friend and associate of Tony Spilaccio, one of my clients, and I went places with him almost in the nature of a bodyguard or a protector.
And Fat Herbie went places with Ted Binion, too. Until January 7th, 1997, when Herbie made headlines, and not in a good way.
I was at the crime scene when Herbie Blitzstein was killed. I was at the murder scene. Yes, I was.
Coming up.
It looked like a classic mob hit. Three bullet holes in the back of his head.
Would Ted be next?
He was feeling not only alone, but a bit paranoid.
He had been Ted Binion's pal, and therefore Sandy's friend too, but he was no more. Herbie Blitzstein, mobster, was dead, murdered in his living room. And veteran crime reporter Kathy Scott said it didn't look like any murder scene she'd ever covered before.
There were a lot of suits walking around, you know, a lot of men in dark suits, and it's like, what are the feds doing here?
Scott checked with then Las Vegas Metro Police Department Homicide Lieutenant Wayne Peterson, who confirmed the men in black were indeed FBI agents, there because of Fat Herbie's mob connections.
And when I went in the scene, it looked like a classic mob hit. Mm. Herbie was kneeling in front of a recliner and, you know, three bullet holes in the back of his head.
Well, at the murder scene, Peterson got a disturbing tip from one of the FBI agents, a friend of his.
And he said, well, you know, we had Herbie under surveillance when he was killed.
The feds had him under surveillance and didn't do anything to stop the murder?
Well, they couldn't know that the two people that went in his condo were there to kill him.
Thing was, as Peterson found out, the feds were watching all the mobsters. Vegas to L.A., Operation Thin Crust, they called it. It was huge, went on for years, as the FBI tried to muscle the mob out of Vegas for good. And at one point, the FBI warned Ted, by way of a local homicide cop, that some of the wise guys were talking about killing him to get to his silver.
And what do you know? 5 months after that warning, somebody blasted Ted's house with a shotgun.
Right through his front window, big, big, wide window.
Well, Ted and Sandy were at home.
They were quite scared after that.
Quite reasonable, given what Kathy was hearing, that the same wise guys who killed Fat Herbie Blitzstein might also be after Ted.
He was feeling not only alone, but a bit paranoid.
Which is the state of mind Ted was apparently in when he had a chance meeting at a restaurant called Piero's.
You may have heard of it. Everybody goes into Piero's.
This is the guy Ted met.
You can go in there in your jeans or you can go in there in a tuxedo. It's a fantastic restaurant.
The guy's name is Rick Tabish. Sound familiar? The guy who got arrested while digging up Ted Silver. He was also in jail when we talked to him back in 2001.
We're at the urinal, and Teddy looks over at me, and he takes his right hand. Obviously, he's right-handed. How you doing, Ted Binion? Right then and there, you're like, you know, I like this guy. He's in jeans, his shirt's untucked, and we started visiting. He asked me where I was from, and I said, Montana. And right from there, I mean, it was click.
Ted's girlfriend, Sandy, though, well, she was another story.
Sandy and I didn't have a real good relationship at first. Sandy was very protective of Teddy.
But as Rick would find out soon enough, Ted was in a world of trouble. His wise guy buddy was dead. His own house had been shot up by somebody. And he was increasingly depressed. Then, within weeks of Rick and Ted's meet cute in the men's room at Piero's, Ted's world came undone. The Gaming Commission, citing his suspected drug use and his alleged mob connections, revoked Ted's gaming license, putting him out of the casino business for life.
I think when he lost his gaming license, that he lost hope. And I think that he wanted something to ease the pain. And that's when he scored his first score of heroin, so to speak, in quite a long period of time. And he always told me once he started that he could never stop.
What would that do to him or for him?
Well, it depends. I can say that it makes him consistently inconsistent, his personality and all of his actions. And you never knew what was going to happen next.
No telling what Ted might do, or what someone might do to him.
Coming up.
Teddy was a little eccentric, and he liked to do things like bury things.
Ted Binion moves his silver. Was he also moving on from Sandy?
I knew that a blow-up was coming.
When Dateline continues.
There was a new boss at the Horseshoe. When Ted was stripped of his gaming license, it brought to head a bitter family fight for control of the casino, a fight which Becky won.
For Ted, the loss was total, catastrophic. Not just the loss of control, not just the loss of his share of the Horseshoe. He wasn't even allowed to step inside the place now that his gaming license was revoked, which meant Ted had to find a place to put his 24 tons of silver, the stuff he had stashed in the casino's basement vault. So he called his buddy Rick Tavish, who just happened to own a whole fleet of trucks. But where, oh where, do you put 24 tons of silver?
We called every place, and there was no place that you could put the silver, and no place he trusted.
Then why not just bury it, Ted said.
Did it make sense, do you think, to put it out in the desert?
No.
Dumb idea?
I thought it was a really dumb idea.
But he liked what he liked. And around town, Ted's penchant for dreaming up bizarre ways to hide his treasure was no secret.
I think that Teddy was a little eccentric, and he was a little Western, and he liked to do things like bury things and do things, I guess, that eccentric cowboys do that are kind of from what we call the old school Las Vegas.
And he says, you know what? I'm going to set it right downtown Pahrump. We're like, you got to be kidding me. Why would you do that? Why don't you put it out the ranch? He says, who'd be dumb enough to go right down to the center of town and steal all this silver? I started thinking about it, and you know, as goofy a thinking as it was, he was absolutely right. So I guess he did it the Binion way.
The Binion way. Eccentric, old-school Las Vegas. So Rick Tavish had a giant concrete safe built and then buried it on Ted's vacant lot in Pahrump, worked 24 hours straight moving Ted's 24 tons of silver from the casino to the desert.
It was a real novelty to go deal with this silver. It was something, you know, it was hard work, but when do you ever have the chance to do it again?
But according to Sandy, even with his silver problem now solved, Ted's heroin use only got worse. He didn't inject it, by the way, no. Ted had a deep-rooted fear of needles. Instead, he used a knife. He would smear the gooey heroin onto a piece of tinfoil, then heat it from below while inhaling the smoke through a pipe. Practice called chasing the dragon. It was bad, said Sandy.
When he didn't get dope in time, he would get sick.
Physically ill.
Very sick. He would throw up. He would lay on the bathroom floor for hours and not be able to move. He couldn't comb his hair. I mean, he would go to the bathroom on himself.
In the 3 years they'd lived together, Sandy said, she'd never seen Ted get this dope sick before. And as he got worse, Sandy leaned on Ted's friend, Rick.
And I became really kind of dependent on his friendship and his support. And I think Teddy did too.
Sandy admitted she had complicated feelings for Ted and for Rick.
I was attracted to him, there's no doubt about it. But I loved Teddy with all my heart, and I had a lot of time invested in our relationship. And it's really hard to be in a position with someone that you love and watch them deteriorate on a daily basis.
Why didn't you walk out on him?
You know, everybody always asks me that question, and it's really tough to answer. But all I can tell you is that when you love somebody and they're sick, where I come from, you don't quit. My dad always used to tell me that tough times never last and tough people do. And if Teddy's what you want, then stand by his side and you'll get through it.
Sandy might have been willing to stick it out, but Ted's sister Becky said her brother wasn't. According to her, Ted's passing fancy was over. He was through with Sandy.
Because I had been speaking to Ted all week and I knew that a blow up was coming. Ted had indicated to me that he definitely was getting rid of Sandy. The end was here.
The end, sadly, was close at hand, though perhaps not as Ted had imagined it.
Coming up, Ted was dead. Overdose?
He was lying on the floor on a mattress.
Suicide?
Ultimately, he didn't want to be here anymore.
Or murder?
I wanted it to be treated as a homicide.
September 17th, 1998, nearly 4 p.m. The mercury was just hitting 100 when Sandy said she came home to find Ted Binion dead on the floor. Too late for that, of course. Now, there are only questions.
Was he lying down?
Yeah, he was lying on the floor on a mattress.
He was discovered by his girlfriend.
Yes.
And given Ted's friendship with a murdered mobster, the assembled media naturally wondered, was that the reason he was dead? No, said the police. Rather definitive here.
We have not seen any signs of foul play regarding his death or any involving any of his prior associations.
There were no wounds or bullet holes, just foils, a knife with the residue of black tar heroin on it, and an empty bottle of Xanax, pills that turned out Ted's doctor had prescribed to help him stop using heroin. But given who it was, and given all the attention, the detective in charge at Ted's house called Homicide Lieutenant Wayne Peterson to give him a heads up anyway.
He says Teddy's found on a mattress in his den, some drug paraphernalia around, you know, what looked to him at the scene like was an obvious drug overdose. And knowing Teddy's background, like everyone in town.
So you were not shocked by this news that you received from your guy at the scene?
No, not at all.
No. And yet, that quick assessment, drug overdose? Oh, what trouble that would cause. For one simple reason.
There was no preserving the crime scene.
As far as police saw it, that day anyway, there was no crime. So, no scene to preserve.
People going in and out, everybody and their brother were walking through the house, his friends and stuff.
Ted's old friend Oscar Goodman felt the need to see it all for himself.
Couldn't believe what I heard and got in my car and went over there.
No, all I say is that he was one of the best guys I ever met. That's it. Thank you.
Ted's newest friend showed up too.
Could you spell your name?
Tabish, T-A-B-I-S-H.
And your family friend of Mr. Binion?
Yeah, I'm just a personal friend of Ted's.
Rick Tabish told the reporters he couldn't believe it.
What were your first thoughts?
What a tragedy. I mean, I know that he was trying real hard to straighten himself out.
It's a hard road to get straight. Sandy told me she thought maybe Ted didn't really want to.
There's a lot of things that happened in the summer of 98 that led me to believe that ultimately he didn't want to be here anymore.
But Ted's sister, Becky, she smelled a rat, and she wasn't happy about the way police were treating his demise.
It's very easy when you have a drug user to just say, you know, he OD'd and sweep it under the carpet. I felt that there was foul play involved, and I wanted it to be treated as a homicide.
The morning after Ted died, Becky took her theory to Las Vegas newspaperman Jeff Gurman. By 11 a.m., Becky was in the Las Vegas Sun, saying it was murder, and that Ted and Sandy had been fighting all week. The implication was pretty obvious.
I know for sure Becky Bannon and Sandy Murphy never got along, and her distrust of Sandy Murphy, it was natural for her to raise the specter of foul play in his death.
So when Sandy returned to the house she shared with Ted, maybe it shouldn't have been a surprise that she found her way blocked by a lawyer sent by Ted's family.
He slams the door in my face.
The lawyer, a guy named James Brown, told Sandy he'd have security call the cops if she tried to go in.
I'm thinking, what a great idea. Let's call the police. I mean, I have no idea what's going on. I call the police. He lies to the police officer and tells him I'm a resident of California, that I don't live in the house.
But Sandy's driver's license said this was where she lived, her home. So the cop told Brown he had to go, and Brown went downtown to talk to a judge while Sandy went inside.
I was told by the security guard that they were hauling stuff up out of the house.
Meaning, people working for the Binions were taking things away without her permission. She was upset, she said. How dare they? So Sandy called Rick Tabish.
I get the phone call from her. She's concerned about what's going on in her house. Hair on my neck raises up. She's my friend. Where I come from, this doesn't happen. I guess if I was in Las Vegas, you mind your own business. You don't worry about everybody else's backyard. Maybe that's what I should have done.
Maybe he should have. Because what happened next would create a big problem for both of them.
Coming up, Sandy documented on video what was happening at the house.
I want everything shown. I don't want anything missing.
Her exact words when she called is they're stealing from Teddy.
Who was?
Ted always said, when I die, they come out like vultures.
When Dateline continues.
They told us you could run out this battery pack. I just filled it up.
Ted Binion had been dead for not quite 24 hours when Rick Tabish rushed over to Ted's house with a video camera for Sandy. The idea being, if Ted's family was taking Sandy's stuff, she'd have a record of what was missing.
So make sure you get a complete inventory of everything.
But Rick didn't stick around. He had somewhere else he needed to be, he said. So Sandy's attorney took the camera and shot this video as Sandy went on a tour of the house.
Nothing of real consequence.
James Brown, the other attorney, the one representing Ted's huge estate, had returned by that time with the judge's permission to be there.
This is the recreation room.
So he went along.
The only thing I could think of is that they're here looting.
By which she meant looting from her, Sandy. Because Ted had written a will stipulating that if he died, she was supposed to get $300,000 plus the house and everything in it. Remember, Ted had certain habits with money. Some people said he had millions squirreled away in that house, in safes, but also in odd, unlikely places like under the cowl of a motorboat engine. So Sandy might have a lot to lose.
No, I want everyone to see everything.
Okay.
I want everything shown. I don't want anything missing.
And she wanted to make sure James Brown knew that she knew exactly what she was entitled to.
And the security guard out front who works for you guys is telling me you unloaded out of the house. That's illegal.
For a little more than 20 minutes, Sandy Murphy went through the house she'd shared with Ted Binion, opening and closing drawers.
There's guns missing in there.
It's a glimpse into their lives together, of expensive things.
Okay, these are all my clothes in the laundry, man. $4,000 suit.
Works of art.
I'm going to leave the Luther Gunther, but I'm going to take the Vargas because I don't trust it, and if it's gone, I'm screwed.
In here was evidence, too, of Ted's struggle with heroin.
I found his heroin deal behind here.
Here we go.
It was perfectly obvious. This was not a friendly little ramble around the house.
That's my purse, Jimmy. Please stay out of it.
Did you just bring it in here?
Yes, I did. Please stay out of it.
An angry Sandy who believed the Binions were stealing from her. A family equally sure she was just a greedy gold digger entitled to nothing. Pleasant, it wasn't. Meanwhile, Rick Tabish was on the move, conducting a second bit of business that police would find very interesting. He told us he got the idea when Sandy called him all upset.
Her exact words when she called is they're stealing from Teddy. She wasn't even selfish enough to say they're taking my things.
Anyway, said Rick, it reminded him of something Ted told him when they were moving his silver out to Pahrump a few months prior.
Ted always said, when I die, they come out like vultures.
By they, Tabish said, Ted meant people related to him. And all of a sudden, said Rick, he felt an urgent need to protect Ted's most prized possession. That is why he took his crew and that belly dump truck and drove out to Pahrump that very night, he said, where, as you no doubt remember, he got arrested. Rick was charged with grand larceny. Bail was set at 100 grand.
So, let's review the betting. Ted Binion dies suddenly. 24 hours later, Sandy is captured on video, vehemently laying claim to expensive things in his house. And just hours after that, Rick is captured, for real, with tons and tons of Ted's silver. And though both insisted they were doing just what Ted wanted them to do, a casual observer might just get the impression Sandy and Rick were trying to cash in on Ted's death. At the very least.
And this didn't help them either. How Rick Tabish made his $100,000 bail? Someone put up Sandy's black Mercedes and lots of diamonds as collateral. That someone was Sandy herself.
Coming up, Binion's lawyer told detectives his marching orders.
Take Sandy out of the will.
And Sandy caught on the tapes she recorded. It didn't look good.
She surreptitiously grabs the wine glass and puts it in her purse. What was that glass used for?
Ted Binion's funeral was a Las Vegas event. Hundreds crowded Christ the King Catholic Church. Someone brought cowboy boots and a hat and lariat for the casket. The press came. Important people came. Mayors, senators. Ted's friend Oscar Goodman accompanied Sandy.
She was grieving. She loved the person whose funeral she was attending.
The one thing about Archie, he'll still be the king of all the time.
Ted's sister Becky was not inclined to believe that.
What did Becky do after Ted's death?
Becky Binion hired a former homicide cop to do an investigation.
Becky hired a private investigator, a former police officer who still had a lot of pull at Vegas PD.
And the homicide cops just said, okay, and he took over the investigation.
But was it even a homicide? The medical examiner announced Ted died of a lethal overdose of heroin and Xanax. Not a surprise. But there was this one unusual thing. The autopsy found heroin residue in Ted's stomach.
That's a big piece of evidence. You know, if Teddy would have overdosed on heroin, he would have done it by smoking it. He would never ingest it.
At least not that you know of.
Well, ask any heroin user. It's a waste of good heroin.
So there was a nugget to work with. And here was another. When the cops searched the house, why didn't they find any of Ted's rumored stash? No gold, no silver, no cash? All they came up with was one single dime at the bottom of a safe.
The idea that that safe would have been kept empty, given the way he lived, not a chance.
No, Teddy wouldn't have an empty safe in his house. Like I said, he was known for walking around with thousands of dollars in his pocket.
If loot was missing from the house, well, that seemed to imply an inside job by someone who had Ted's keys and combinations.
Well, there's $20,000 in the house, and it's not here now. Well.
In that video shot by her lawyer, Sandy Murphy complained that money was missing. So who took it? The Binions? The mob? Or Sandy herself? 4 days after Ted died, Binion lawyer James Brown met with homicide detectives to say it must have been Sandy. Sandy, with a motive as obvious, said Brown, as the neon on the strip. Brown said he talked to Ted day before he died and got the following instruction. 6 little words.
Take Sandy out of the will.
The day Ted died, Sandy seemed so distraught she'd been hauled off to the hospital, where she could barely speak to the detective who went to see her.
Sandy, when was the last time you saw him alive?
Oh, when I left the hospital.
Listen carefully as the detective talks with Sandy. The cop sure did. She's so overwrought she really doesn't have anything to add to the investigation. Well, then ask yourself, does this sound like a grief-stricken woman or a woman who is trying to sound grief-stricken?
Sandy, do you remember what time you found him when you came back home? How long were you gone from the house?
Police compared Sandy at the hospital with Sandy at the house just a day later.
And don't worry, they'll steal anything they get their hands on.
They believed the real Sandy came out on day 2, and they took particular interest in what happened here. Look closely as Sandy passes by the kitchen counter.
Okay, can I have some more light here?
And she surreptitiously grabs the wine glass and puts it in her purse. It's like, why did she do that? What was that glass used for?
The house, as you'll recall, wasn't treated like a crime scene. Nobody collected or tested that wine glass. And now, of course, it was gone. So the Binion PI and the police conducted more interviews. Ted's housekeeper told them that Sandy called her that day, told her, stay home. Ted's gardener said he was at the house that day and remembered something unusual.
All the blinds were closed that day, and they are usually never were closed. Another circumstance that just added to the suspicion.
Suspicion that behind closed curtains, they can be seen closed the next day on the video shot by Sandy's attorney. Sandy and Rick might have used that wine glass to slip Ted a lethal combination of drugs before he could change his will and before he found out about them.
Police found records to show that just a few days before Ted died, Sandy came here to California for a romantic getaway. She even called ahead to the hotel to order roses and wine for the room to surprise her husband. Except Sandy wasn't married, and she wasn't here with Ted. Oh, no.
Sandy signed the register as S.M. Tabish, as in Rick Tabish, who was there with her. Sex and money, classic motives for murder, but not enough for an arrest. So Ted's family tried to juice the investigation and hauled Sandy and Rick into probate court to get answers under oath about what happened to Ted. Easier said than done.
Upon advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based on my rights under the Fifth Amendment of the
More than 200 times, Sandy pleaded the Fifth. The lawyers heard the same response from Rick 98 times.
Are my rights supported by the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments?
Oscar Goodman was Sandy's lawyer at the time and said she had a perfect right to take the Fifth.
They wanted to make it into a big investigation here, and
I wasn't about to play that game.
Soon, the actual investigators found an old friend of Rick's who told them that before Ted died, Rick asked him to help kill a wealthy casino owner. And they found the manicurist who told police Sandy spoke of her rich boyfriend dying from a drug overdose 1 week before he actually did. The evidence was piling up. And in late June 1999, 9 months after Ted died, Rick and Sandy were grocery shopping when police surprised them with handcuffs. The charges were grand theft, conspiracy, and the murder of Ted Binion.
Coming up, Sandy has a new man in her life.
He footed the bill on everything.
Many whispers about that, I'm thinking.
There are people, of course, she's having an affair with him.
When Dateline continues.
They'd be tried together, it was decided. Sandy and Rick tried for grand theft and conspiracy and murder in the first degree. But before the trial, young Sandy and her plight caught the eye of a gentleman of a certain age, a man named Bill Fuller.
He was wealthy, a big entertainment guy in Ireland, quite well known.
Who now lived and worked in Las Vegas. And as an Irish expat, it pained Fuller to see a colleen named Murphy in chains for crimes he felt she couldn't possibly have committed. Fuller started visiting Sandy in jail.
Are you going to get a chance to visit her?
Yeah.
Later today?
Thank you.
And he saw the pickle she was in, and she couldn't afford a good defense.
But Fuller could. So, for a start, he posted Sandy's bail. He set her up in an apartment of her own, hired a team of top defense attorneys.
He footed the bill on everything.
Many whispers about that, I'm thinking.
Oh, there are people, of course, she's having an affair with him, but he was a nice man. He wanted to help her, and he could afford to, and so he did.
Which may explain why Sandy's demeanor in court almost said, "I got this." She even painted the tracking bracelet on her ankle to match her outfit, which played into a now widely held perception that she wasn't taking her arrest or the trial or even Ted's death very seriously. Prosecutor David Rogers said that's what came through in the video she made the day after Ted died.
She walked into the den where she had found, allegedly, the love of her life. Some 24 hours earlier, dead, and not even a tear.
And listen to this, said the prosecutor.
The safe's empty, there's nothing in it.
It goes by quick, but Sandy said, the safe is empty, there's nothing in there. But as you can see for yourself, the safe door is closed, which begs the question.
How did she know this safe was empty, unless she took the items?
And after Ted's death, Prosecutor David Wall said, Rick Tabish gave his brother-in-law rare silver coins in exchange for a loan.
And they were the same type of coins that were in Ted Binion's safe in his garage.
Prosecutors told the jury the most incriminating part of the video was this. The clip where Sandy appears to be putting a wine glass in her purse.
We believe that that glass was used to give Ted Binion the lethal cocktail.
What makes you think that that was the glass that was used to administer the potion?
Both medical examiners believed that if Ted Binion had taken the 50 or 60 Xanax pills, you would find particles within the stomach. They did not find any, which suggested to them that the Xanax and the heroin had been liquefied.
How did you propose that he could have been actually forced to drink this cocktail of heroin and Xanax? I mean, how do you force somebody to drink a cocktail?
The same way you force a child to take their medicine when they don't want to. Ted Binion was restrained. There were marks on his wrist. Perhaps they squeezed his nose. We don't know. But it's not impossible to do.
But as they admitted, that was all just opinion. Was there a drug cocktail at all? Or did Ted OD by accident, or did he do it on purpose? Who really knew?
but the prosecutor needed to prove murder. And that's where this witness came in. Celebrity pathologist Michael Bodden, who at the time was hosting the HBO show Autopsy.
He died from some obstruction to his nose and mouth, couldn't breathe in, and pressure on his chest.
It was like a scene right out of his TV show. With his skills and training, Bodden said he saw things others obviously did not.
He went to the coroner's office and reviewed tissue samples, took a closer look at the rest of the photographs taken by police crime scene analysts, and determined that Ted Binion had been suffocated.
In fact, Bodden revived a very old word to describe what may have happened. An 18th century word, as a matter of fact, for a deadly technique called burking, suffocation by sitting on the chest and starving the lungs of air. That, he said, is what happened to Ted Binion.
He explained in detail why suffocation was one of the most difficult things for a medical examiner to interpret, because it's designed not to leave any marks.
Except, said Bodden, in the autopsy photo, he could see on Ted's chest the impression left by a shirt button pushed into the skin of a dying man. An impression intended to make an impression on the jury. As was this, and it was big. Ted's estate lawyer's story. The claim about what Ted told him day before he died.
Takes Andy out of the will if she doesn't kill me tonight.
And then James Brown testified, Ted said this.
If I'm dead, you'll know what happened.
Coming up.
Did you and Rick Tavish kill Ted Binion?
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of.
Would a jury agree?
We, the jury in the above entitled case, find the defendant, Sandra Renee Murphy, as follows.
Teddy knew the score the first time he got high, and he knew the score the last time he was going to get high when he ordered 12 balloons of tar heroin from the drug dealer and went over and got a script of Xanax for 120 pills. He knew what the end result was going to be, and he chose to do it anyway.
And that was the defense in a nutshell. Ted Binion died from his own actions. Well, Sandy was an innocent, sucked into an obscene Las Vegas multiverse of heroin, casinos, mobsters, and treasure that was way beyond her comprehension. All capped off by being the one to discover Ted's body.
I rolled him over, and I plugged his nose, and I put his head back, and I performed CPR.
Ted's addiction to heroin was well known to those who followed the news. It was one of the reasons Ted lost his gaming license. And the fact Ted died while using drugs? No surprise there. Remember Ted's attorney, James Brown, the one who testified Ted told him the night before he died to...
Take Sandy out of the will if she doesn't kill me tonight.
But under cross-examination, Brown admitted even he at first thought that Ted's death was due to his drug use.
My opinion was that he died of a heart attack. Years of abusing his body had finally caught up to him, and he died of a heart attack.
Having pried out that admission, the defense tore into the videotape Sandy made the day after Ted died.
But I'm going to take the Vargas because I don't trust it, and if it's gone, I'm screwed.
Well, you bet she was angry, her defense attorney said. Had good reason to be angry because, according to Ted's will, she was to inherit the house and everything inside. So why was Ted's family cleaning the place out?
Ultimately, I never knew what was taken out of the house. I only knew what I took out of the house that day in fear that I was being robbed. That is the reason for my actions on the videotape. I mean, I don't know how else I can explain it.
She stuffed the wine glass in her purse, she told me, to hide the fact she'd been drinking. Didn't want people judging her for it. But in the trial, the prosecution slapped on a guilt interpretation, just as they did about the silver heist at Pahrump. Except the defense said that wasn't a heist at all. Deputies Dean Pinnock and Ed Howard both testified Rick Tavish did call the sheriff before pulling the silver out of the ground.
Mr. Tavish advised you that he had talked to the sheriff three times that day, correct?
That's correct.
You became aware that the sheriff had confirmed talking with Mr. Tavish, correct?
That's correct.
Next, the defense took on the prosecution's star witness, Michael Bodden, who testified that Ted Binion was suffocated to death. The defense called its own star pathologist, Cyril Wecht.
Have a seat, sir.
Thank you.
Who seemed to think Bodden's theory about Birking was outlandish and wrong.
I would consider the manner of death more likely than not to have been suicide.
Suicide by drug overdose. Just what Sandy told me. And with that to consider, the jury was sent off to deliberate. And did they ever? One day? 2 days? A week? Rick's lawyer, Louis Palazzo.
I felt like that we would have probably a hung jury.
Then, on the eighth day, they decided. Rick and Sandy both came to court as if dressed for a funeral. They were told to stand as the verdict was read.
We, the jury in the above entitled case, find the defendant, Richard Bennett Tavish, as follows. Guilty of murder of the first degree. We, the jury in the above entitled case, find the defendant, Sandra Renee Murphy, as follows. Guilty of murder of the first degree.
Guilty on all counts and sentenced to life in prison.
There's a question I generally refrain from asking people accused of murder. Did you do it? After all, how could I expect someone who'd so vigorously defended his or her innocence in court to suddenly decide to confess on national television? But Sandy had been convicted. A jury said she did it. So, for the record...
Did you and Rick Tavish kill Ted Binion?
No way. I would never hurt Teddy. I've never hurt anyone in my life. And that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of.
When the jury reached its verdict, had you thought that you had a chance before they announced what the verdict was?
No, I knew I lost.
Because, she said, so many jurors were wearing sunglasses.
I said, everybody here is hiding. Something went wrong back there. And that's why they have those sunglasses on.
You knew they were going to convict you?
Absolutely, without a doubt.
And they didn't want you to see into their eyes?
Absolutely.
Are there some days when you say to yourself, good God, if I'd just not taken that vacation to Las Vegas?
I'm not sorry for any of it. I had a great relationship with a man I loved, and it's unfortunate that he's not here anymore and that he can't be with me, but I'm not sorry that I ever met him, and I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to love him and to know him as the man I did, and that's the way I'll always remember him.
Even if you never get out of jail?
I don't believe that'll ever happen. I believe in the truth, and God is on my side. And miracles happen every day.
Naive, huh? Seemed that way to me. Almost childlike as I watched her serenely go off to serve a life sentence for murder. But in Las Vegas, as everybody knows, your luck can always change.
Coming up.
This defendant was convicted in this case on the basis of insufficient evidence.
Sandy gets one more roll of the dice and another roller coaster ride.
It's just very scary. My freedom hangs in the balance of 12 people who don't know who I am.
When Dateline continues.
It was odd, to be frank. Sandy Murphy had just been sent away for life, and yet here, back in 2001, she seemed at peace about it.
If that is God's will, and I stay in prison for whatever reason or purpose he has in store for me, then so be it.
But Sandy's benefactor, Bill Fuller, was not at peace. No, he was so darn angry, he fired Sandy's defense team and brought the famous Alan Dershowitz in to file an appeal.
The first case on the court's calendar this morning is 36873, Richard Bennett Tavish and Sandra Renee Murphy, appellants versus the state of Nevada.
When the case was finally heard by the Nevada State Supreme Court, Dershowitz argued Rick and Sandy simply did not get a fair trial.
That this defendant was convicted in this case on the basis of insufficient evidence.
Remember that testimony from Ted's lawyer?
Take Sandy out of the will if she doesn't kill me tonight.
Hearsay, said Dershowitz. No way to prove Ted actually said that. Yet the jury heard it stated as fact. And there was something else off about the trial. Rick, but not Sandy, was also charged and convicted of extortion with a deadly weapon, a completely separate case involving a former business partner. And it should have been a separate trial, too, said Dershowitz. It had nothing whatever to do with Sandy. Yet how could a jury think otherwise? She was sitting right there in the courtroom. And the justices of the Supreme Court of Nevada agreed. Rick and Sandy would get a new trial. And once again, Sandy's benefactor, Bill Fuller, bailed her out of jail. And this time hired a young, unknown attorney to represent her.
The evidence will demonstrate that Sandy couldn't kill anything.
Sandy's attorney, Michael Cristalli.
When the first trial was going on, I was probably around 30 years old had about 5-6 years under my belt.
Rick Tabish went with an old-timer named Tony Serra, a brilliant social justice lawyer and courtroom showman.
Remember what the charges are. You got to keep your eye on that. Boiling them down, it's stealing and killing.
Once again, Dr. Michael Bodden was a key witness for the prosecution. And as before, he presented his Birking theory.
In my opinion, the findings here are indicative of Birking type of suffocation.
Bodden came to that conclusion, you'll remember, after looking at autopsy photos, in one of which he believed he saw a button impression on Ted Binion's chest, as if someone sat on him, pushed the button into his flesh. And that was like catnip to attorney Serra. He went after Bodden hard. Since the famous pathologist never actually examined Ted's body, or his shirt, or that button, how could he possibly be so sure?
You'd like the shirt, you'd like to look at the buttons, you'd like to measure the buttons, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You'd want to know how thick the button is, what the button's made of, you know, how much pressure before a button would break. You'd want to experiment, wouldn't you, in a serious case?
Okay. Well, first of all cases are serious.
All right.
Secondly, no, I wouldn't experiment.
The interesting thing that we were able to do that they didn't do during the first trial is blow that button mark up. And once that button mark was blown up, you could see that it wasn't a button mark. It was a carcinoma.
Pustule skin cancer. Anyway, the heroin and Xanax in Ted Binion's system were quite enough to kill him, according to the county medical examiner.
When he ruled accidental overdose, found no signs of suffocation, no signs of strangulation.
So far, so good for the defense. And then, on the last day of the defense's case, Tony Serra called Rick Tabish to the stand. Michael Cristalli's heart sank.
I was very nervous.
After 5 years behind bars, Rick Tabish had been stripped of just about everything he had, except his confidence.
The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
So Rick thought there was no better person than he to make his case to the jury.
Calling your attention to September 17th of 1998. Did you have anything to do with the death of Ted Binion?
Absolutely and unequivocally not. I did not kill Ted Binion.
I just started connecting with him. I was talking to those people. That's why I wanted to look in their eyes.
But maybe Rick was a little overconfident in his ability to persuade a jury. Remember, quite aside from the Binion murder was his extortion conviction involving a former business partner. That conviction was never overturned. The prosecutor pounced.
And we should believe you even though you've been convicted of assault with a deadly weapon, correct?
Yes.
And we should believe you even though you've been convicted of false imprisonment with a deadly weapon.
Yes.
Judge, I have nothing else. Thank you very
much. Rick had some problems because of some other events in his life that the prosecution bloodied him up with a bit.
But if defense attorney Tony Serra thought it was a mistake for Rick to testify, he certainly didn't show it. In his closing, he summoned the theatrics he was famous for and seemed to blame all of Las Vegas and its culture of avarice for Ted Binion's death.
It's the casinos. They rise high into the heavens. The neon lights are blinding. Each casino is like an ancient palace.
And the Binions, Sarah said, their story was as old as ancient Rome. An entitled family out to avenge Ted's death by laying their poisonous accusations at the feet of Rick and Sandy.
Mr. Ted Binion was a demigod. He lies fallen on his shield. Hail Caesar! We will find an assailant. The head must be brought forth and placed on the stick by dusk.
And so, for the second time, Sandy and Rick's fates were in the hands of a jury. I spoke with Sandy while they deliberated. I was surprised she even showed up. She was shaking so.
Well, it's just very scary. You know, my freedom hangs in the balance of 12 people who don't know who I am and what I stand for. And that's the hardest part.
Complete loss of any control at all.
I don't have any control over it.
Sandy insisted she was the victim of a wrongful prosecution pushed by the Binion family.
I don't know that I believe they ever believed that there was a murder.
Oh, sure. That's what this is all about. Of course they believed it was
a murder. I think it was about disinheritance.
Sandy, you'll remember, stood to inherit $300,000, Ted's house, and all its contents.
The amount you would receive would be peanuts to that family. Because you weren't going to get the casino. You weren't going to get a huge, vast fortune, no matter what you did. So why would they go after you for basically pocket change?
I think they wanted to disinherit me.
Is there any way you can tell me how you feel about that?
Well, Teddy used to say you should never have hate in your heart. And whatever the family has or hasn't done, they'll have to live with, not me.
Well, you might, with all due respect, you might have to live with that. Can you ever see yourself accepting the version of events which has been portrayed?
No. I don't know how anyone can accept something other than the truth.
4 days after we recorded this interview, there was an announcement. The jury had reached a verdict. It had been 6 years since Ted Binion died. Sandy, convicted of his murder, spent 4 of those years in prison, had endured 2 lengthy trials, and now, as if in some horror story on repeat, was living through her second judgment day. Rick seemed upbeat as spectators trickled into the gallery. But Sandy stayed tucked into a corner of the courtroom and braced herself for a return to prison. Time passed. No sign of the judge or the jury. Sandy began to vomit into a wastebasket. Finally, the court was called to order, and she collected herself.
All right, Miss Foreperson, please read the verdicts aloud, starting from the very top, in that order, please. Mr. Tavish, Ms. Murphy, I'd like you to stand up and face the jury.
We, the jury in the above-entitled case, find the defendant, Sandra Renee Murphy, as follows. Count 1, conspiracy to commit murder and or robbery. We find the defendant not guilty. Count 2, murder, open murder. We find the defendant not guilty.
Not guilty of the murder of Ted Binion. Same verdict for Rick Tabish. There was a but, however, and it was a big one. Rick and Sandy were convicted again of stealing Ted Binion's silver. What with those other charges, Rick would stay several more years in prison. But that was okay, he said.
It's been 6 years, but I haven't become institutionalized. I stayed busy enough in here. I believe I can do as well or better than I did the first time I was out.
Sandy also received a 1 to 5 year sentence for the silver theft, but she got credit for time served and was set free. Couldn't get out of Las Vegas fast enough. Headed straight back to Southern California and the boundless Pacific Ocean, where we met again.
Did you ever think about this particular place when you were in prison?
Well, after, first you do, you try to go to places that are comforting to you, places that are familiar, where you feel safe. But after a while, then you think, did I really do that? Because it doesn't even seem like a memory, which is possible. Something that's sort of impossible, unattainable.
And maybe a little painful to think about?
Yes.
And here you are. Who'd have thought?
Here I am. I'm happy to be home. Grateful to be home.
The end of the story? Not quite. There's an epilogue of sorts. Two, actually. With Rick and Sandy's acquittals, Ted Binion's death, in a way, remains a mystery. Sandy's lawyer from her first trial told us way back in 2001 he heard that the same mobsters who killed Binion's mafioso friend Fat Herbie Blitzstein also planned to kill Ted. What's more, we've learned one of Herbie Blitzstein's killers told the FBI after his arrest that he and two cronies planned on killing Binion by first paralyzing him with a taser and then giving him an overdose of heroin. As we were doing the reporting on this story, I talked on the phone with a guy who used to be a member of the L.A. Mafia. Then he went into the witness protection program, and he didn't want the call recorded. But he told me that when he was in Vegas in the late 90s, having meetings with fellow mobsters, some of them talked about killing Ted. Same scumbags who killed Herbie Blitzstein, he said. And they all knew that Ted had silver buried everywhere. And then he said, so when Ted died, I thought, these guys did it. Sandy's lawyer, Michael Cristalli, said he doesn't believe a word of it. Or even that Ted's death was a murder.
There's no evidence to suggest in this case that the mob was involved in his death.
Didn't Ted pass on, you know, rumors that he'd heard that somebody was coming after him? And there was a shot, somebody took a shot through his house? I mean, the guy was worried, face it.
Yeah, that's true. There were threats made to Ted. There was a shot fired at his house. But there's no evidence to suggest that it was related.
Ted's good friend and former Vegas Mayor Oscar Goodman never believed the mob or Sandy or even Ted intentionally caused his death.
I don't see any reason why anybody would want to kill Teddy. Whatever happened to him, in my opinion, had to have been accidental. I just don't see him doing harm to himself.
So the tale of the mobsters, true or not, that's the first epilogue. The second is about second chances. Rick Tabish got out of prison in 2010. He returned to Montana, got into the oil services business, and by his own account, made a bundle. After time served for digging up silver bullion with a backhoe, he now runs a business building server farms to mine cryptocurrency. Talk about old school versus new. As for Sandy, she never got a dime from Ted Binion's estate, but she's done well. Settled down, got married, had two children, and with her husband opened an art gallery not far from where we recorded this interview.
There's no waves today, too bad.
And not far from where she stopped me that day on the highway, eager to tell me about her new life, finally the life she dreamed of, far, far from Las Vegas.
That's all for this edition of Dateline. We'll see you again next Friday at 9, 8 Central. And of course, I'll see you each weeknight for NBC Nightly News. I'm Lester Holt. For all of us at NBC News, good night.